This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Squibs and Mundanes, representation of disability in speculative fiction.
Wow, I have the most major sense of deja vu, Jules.
Me too. I know, it's almost like we've done this before.
It's almost as if we started recording this episode, but then realised it wasn't actually recording, so we've gotten halfway, not halfway into it.
So we got about 12 minutes in.
We got 12 minutes in and realised that none of what we'd said had been registered, which means the genius that we unleashed upon the world will always be contained between only the two of us.
It's lost forever.
It's lost forever. Yeah.
So sorry about that. But yeah, Madeleine was alerted by my sudden spate of swearing. Which the subject matter didn't really call for at the time.
Yeah, it's like, oh, why is she swearing?
So, anyway. Little hiccup aside.
Okay. So this week we are talking about disability and its representation in speculative fiction. Now, the idea for this episode came from an interesting post that I saw about Harry Potter, and in particular about squibs and how squibs were handled in Harry Potter, and how some people are reading that squibs as disability. Now, previously, J.K. Rowling came forward and said that there wouldn't really be any disability in the Harry Potter universe simply because magic would stop that from happening.
Yeah, there'd be a magic cure for everything, which in it is a problematic thing in itself, for one thing. We'll go into that later. But also begs the question, why does Harry need glasses to correct his vision?
Right?
It's like, so if someone severs their spine, you're good with that, but if it's anything to do with short-sightedness, it's like, oh no, we're not touching that.
We're just gonna put a child on a broomstick with glass around his eyes. He's fine.
Yeah, so
good thinking.
And I guess what it really comes down to is the fact that when she wrote the books, I mean, she wasn't being non-inclusive, but she wasn't necessarily thinking of disability.
No.
And actually, and this might be unpopular, but that's okay. You know, they were written, the first one came out 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's not a case of that you shouldn't have disabled characters, and you absolutely should, but when you first write a book as an author, that might not be the first thing you think about unless it's within your realms of experience.
Yeah. Now, one thing that, can be said is that J.K. Rowling covered quite a lot of issues. In particular, she looked at prejudice, she looked at poverty. And that's something I think is often forgotten, is that she really did look at sort of at poverty within families. The Weasleys, she dealt with those subjects very, very well.
She took quite a shrewd look at child abuse in itself, both for Harry, for Sirius himself, because that was quite an abusive situation when he was a child.
Yeah.
She looked at indoctrination.
Yeah. So, I mean, and these, these were things which were topics on her mind. And, also she looked at loss and death. Because she herself had suffered some terrible loss and some terrible circumstances in her life. So she didn't go into it thinking about disability. Now, because obviously she's so popular, and because the world is so well known now, there is this demand for people to be represented. People want to be represented, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it is part of a much bigger issue about how disability, because we're concentrating on that in this episode, has been represented in the past in media. Now, someone came forward basically and said that actually in Harry Potter, disability is represented, and it's represented through the Squibs. They are the disabled of the magic community, and they are treated appallingly. Now, I can definitely see where that interpretation comes from. The way that squibs are sort of treated, the kind of the segregation they get, the fact that they're, you know, that they're kind of pushed out by society, they're not really considered. I mean, it makes me think of the anti-vaxxers' mums, you know. No, my child will have autism. Autism is the worst thing in the entire world. I would really rather not vaccinate my child just in case they do get autism. Like, even if that was true, autism is definitely still better than death, bringing back age-old viruses. But, you know, you look at sort of the way that the squibs were treated, and sort of the analogies that can be pulled about the squibs, and I can see their point.
Yeah, and certainly when you if you read fiction and you're kind of looking for something that represents you, yeah, then I can kind of see why you might latch onto that, and why if there's a parallel between that and your experiences, you might say, oh, hang on a minute, what's this saying about people who are differently abled?
Yeah.
I don't personally, to me, it doesn't read like that. It doesn't read like it's intentional. But
no,
the squibs always made me feel a bit uncomfortable, and I thought perhaps they were supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I always thought that the squibs were sort of meant to make you feel uncomfortable, because actually there's a lot of things that happen in the Wizarding World which are supposed to make you feel uncomfortable, which don't get resolved. For instance, the issue with the house elves never really gets resolved.
Yeah, we're not supposed to think that the Wizarding World is this paradise of amity at the end, are we?
No, we're not, and it's certainly not represented in that way. I mean, part of Harry growing up is realising that the Wizarding World isn't paradise, and in fact, they're sort of dumb. Seriously.
Yeah.
The Wizarding World is so dumb.
He's just come from such an emotionally abusive background that to him it does seem like paradise. He belongs somewhere, there's so many people who love him.
Yeah. So it is an interesting read. I think I agree with it on a certain level, and I think I can understand why it has people really upset, because as Jill says, if you see yourself represented in this piece of work, and you see sort of represented some of the experiences that you've had, the cruel segregation of people who are disabled, the way that they're treated, the way that they're kind of brushed under the carpets by families, you know, the way that they're put to the side, the way that in media they're always represented as being represented as being resentful, means that you see that, you see yourself represented in that way, and you feel attacked. You feel like, oh great, even in this world that I love, this world that I want to feel that I belong in, this is my role.
Yeah.
And this will always be my role. Because you're not represented in any other point. There are no characters who represent you otherwise, so you can only see yourself in the squibs and the way that they've been treated. And that's very upsetting, and I can really understand that. And I think it all, in the end, comes down to intention. Now, I don't know whether on a subconscious level that it came into it even a little bit. J.K. Rowling was influenced by the media around her and the way that they treated, you know, people with disability. And maybe on a subconscious level, it wasn't that she was thinking that the squibs were going to be disabled, but those kind of characteristics that were shoved so often into media sort of shone through regardless. The point is, the intention wasn't there. The squibs are not meant to represent disability. They've been read that way, but that was never the intention.
No. And one thing I would say, though, thinking about it, is I think you're onto something when you talk about the very fact that certainly when it originally was written, disability wouldn't have been as discussed as it even is now.
Yeah.
So the fact that it was shuffled off to the side, and this swivel, they're happier amongst muggles of their own kind of thing. and out of the view of the wizarding world, etc., does kind of make you think that there still is that sort of, or certainly there was, and to some extent still is, that sense of, oh, well, we better move it out of the way because it's quite upsetting.
Yeah.
Type feeling. And I don't know, it's a thing, as you've said, that, you know, the wizards, the squibs aren't particularly treated badly, but they're treated without understanding.
Yeah.
And
but then
there's a fear there, I think, and it is again that there but the grace of God go I kind of thing, you know, it could be me.
Yeah, there is a fear there, but we say that they're not treated badly. They are ridiculed. I mean, when the sort of Umbridge's government comes into power, squibs are treated badly.
Yes, Umbridge is pretty much Hitler, though.
Yes, she is.
So what she's basically doing is more or less rounding them up into concentration camps. I don't think that's not even a very highly disguised metaphor, really.
No, it isn't. But once again, yeah, that they then sort of do kind of represent the disabled community in that sense, and the way that the disabled community historically were treated. The other thing is actually sort of the way that the wizarding world kind of treats their kids. So we'll look at sort of Neville Longbottom. Now, Neville Longbottom, at one point, they were afraid that he might be a squib. And he was subjected to all sorts of stuff which really isn't appropriate for a child or anyone really to be subjected to, in order to scare him into doing magic. And he was put into dangerous situations. Regardless again of the intention of danger, these were dangerous situations whereby it was accepted, and this person who had put him into dangerous situations was welcomed back several times to continue putting this child into dangerous situations in order to make him display magic. And the idea that actually that was okay because the alternative was that he might just be a squib, it is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It was also the way, of course, and you know, this comes into several bits, as Jules said earlier, the way that this fact is introduced, it is introduced comically. Like, Neville sort of like, yeah, they hanged me out of a window, and then he dropped me, and, oh, they were so happy when I did magic, they cried. And I'm like, shouldn't they be crying because they dropped you out of a bloody window?
Yeah. Obviously, they didn't intend to drop him. It was just a case of wasn't paying attention to what he was doing, and you should never really hold an 11-year-old or 10-year-old out of a window, or any child, in all fairness,
and threaten to drop them.
No,
regardless of what he actually intended to do. So it's very disturbing, because even Neville was sort of made to think, "Oh no, this is fine. It's a joke. Everything's fine because I turned out to be magic," and a lot of people said, but what would have happened if he hadn't? Would things have escalated? How far would things have gone?
It's an interesting point that, you know, what would have happened if he hadn't have been, and maybe it would have escalated. But I think there's also an element of that complete lack of confidence in his abilities transferred to him.
Yeah.
All the way up through school, right up until you get to sort of about the fifth or sixth book, he's a bit damp, isn't he? He really genuinely cannot seem to get things right. And I think McGonagall even says at one point, there's nothing wrong with you except your confidence.
Yeah. And the sort of the pressure that he's been put on by his family, because his parents were such great wizards. So it's troubling. Now, speaking of his parents, this is another instance of hiding sort of people with disability, because it could be argued that his parents are disabled.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, I'm sure people have read the books, but they were tortured until their minds basically broke under the strain.
Yeah.
And they're permanently in St. Mungo's Hospital, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they don't recognise Neville, and they never really have, because he was a baby when it happened to them, and he's visited them with his grandmother all the time. Interestingly enough, his grandmother has, when she finds out that Neville hasn't mentioned his parents to his friends, actually tells Neville off and says, you should be proud of your parents.
Yeah.
So it's not about hiding them away for her. But
no.
At the same time, I think Neville would have rather he had parents who hadn't fought and just knew who he was.
Yeah.
And that might also be feeding into his lack of confidence and lack of willingness to get to grips with magic.
Well, I also think that it hurts for Neville, and that's something that makes him very vulnerable, is to say that actually I don't have parents, and he doesn't really kind of want to be, not looked down on, but sort of pitied.
Yeah.
Which is, it's hard enough, because actually he's kind of been the butt of jokes, and he's kind of pitied anyway, because he's so bad at everything. But he's not really bad at everything, and there's a reason he's in Gryffindor, you know.
Yeah.
So, it is interesting, and he's an interesting character. I guess the reason it got to me, on a personal level, was that when my mum was sick, we had to have sort of 24-hour care to help out with her. And when these nurses, bearing in mind we were in the Middle East at the time, when these nurses would come, they were shocked that not only was my mother in the same part of the house as everyone else, she was in the same room as my dad, and that they shared a bed together.
Yeah.
And there was this element, and in England as well, and in Europe as well, there has been this history of just hush, hush, quiet, quiet, put them in a room, don't let anyone see them. And that was within our own royal family, you know, it was everywhere. The whole kind of Rochester hiding his wife in the attic. I mean, it wasn't strange. I mean, it's horrifically strange and very odd, but the hiding of people with disability, or the taking of entertainment from them, that this view that it was a shameful secret that couldn't be allowed out.
Well, yeah, if you were a woman with epilepsy, you were considered to be a sexual deviant, and you tended to end up in an asylum.
Yeah, which is great fun. And horrifically cruel. And historically kind of what happened.
But, I mean, it depends. It tended to be the upper classes that did this.
Yeah.
To be in the more sort of working classes, the lower classes, obviously you wouldn't have the wherewithal in the first place. There was a bigger sense of community and family, and you tended not to live as long.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might not have survived to adulthood if you had something like epilepsy.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying that one's better than the other, I'm just saying that obviously it depends really, doesn't it? But certainly if you were supposed to be representative of all the best that was in humanity in Britain, at least, yes, you did tend to hide your relatives away if there was something a bit wrong with them.
Yeah. And so there's this, now again, it's not done on purpose, and I like the fact that, you have Neville's grandmother saying, no, why haven't you told anyone about this? You should be proud. And again, I understand Neville's reasons, but there was this kind of quietly tuck people into the corner. The fact that no one really, no one knew what had happened to Gilderoy Lockhart.
No, it's quite hard to feel sorry for Gilderoy Lockhart, since that's what he was trying to do to Harry and Ron.
Yes, it is rather hard. You know, that it's just an example, and obviously that's played off as comic. But this is a character who essentially kind of has dementia.
Yes. again, a tricky one because, yeah, it's most people who end up with dementia haven't gone out and got it for themselves, whereas he actually did. So, and he is actually recovering at that point when they see him.
Yeah. But it's... Yeah, the St. Mungo's thing was actually just quite interesting in general, and I'm kind of glad that we saw it,
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think with some of this, it's a case of the books at the beginning of the series just weren't big enough.
Yeah, oh,
Um,
that's fair enough.
and that's fair enough. And as the books got bigger and you needed to incorporate more of the world, I mean, you get the impression that she knew all the time that this was there, kind of
Yeah.
thing. It's just she hadn't needed to talk about it before then.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's good. And they obviously get more complex and more nuanced as they go on as well, which is also something that does happen with series and
Yeah.
should happen.
The question now is that, a lot of the defenses that we have, for lack of representation within the Harry Potter universe is the fact that it was written 20 years ago, and it was the start, but the world is now getting bigger, and with the new films coming out and new content within Harry Potter, the question sort of rises of whether we're going to see any more representation. Now, there's quite a few people, myself included, who actually read Newt Scamander as autistic or on the autistic spectrum. Now, whether that has been done intentionally, whether it was the actor's decision to sort of with the portrayal of whether it is actually a conscious decision to specifically put him on the kind of the spectrum, I like the way that he's been done, and I think that a lot of people actually really like the idea that he may be is it atypical?
Neuro typical.
Neurotypical, sorry. That he may be neurotypical. What do you think?
Well, I personally didn't read him that way, and I say read because obviously what I actually mean is watch, because there isn't a novelization. I'd love there to be a novelization of it, I really would, but there
Yeah.
isn't.
Yet.
Not yet. This is what happens. I see a great film and I want to see a perfect novelization of it, so I really get to read it. But I can see what you mean, and I like it that it's open-ended. I don't necessarily think I personally want it to come down on one side or the other, but if that was, say, Eddie Redmayne's interpretation of the character, someone who's more comfortable with animals and that might possibly be because of being neuroatypical, then yeah, great, I'm all for that.
Yeah. It would certainly be interesting. And I think that I would like it, because now there isn't an excuse of period now. The world is getting bigger. The visual signs on screen, we should be seeing more representation now. We shouldn't just be seeing more of the same. Part of the beauty of Harry Potter with the books was that the world did get bigger and it did raise other issues. So I would really, really like to see more of that represented. Now, another way that it is represented is with the character of Clarence. No, his name's not
Did you
Clarence.
say Credence?
Credence, thank you. Clarence is the angel in It's a Wonderful Life.
Hate that film so much. Anyway, please carry on.
Yes, we'll talk about weird communist films later. So Credence, it could again be argued the sort of the thing that happens to him with the I don't remember what it's called, the dark thing, his power that sort of
Yeah.
bursts out. It could be argued that it is kind of actually a form of disability. It's something which kind of is sort of taking control of him that he doesn't really have that much control over. And he's not in a good position. I would definitely say that he's suffering from terrible trauma.
Yeah, did you read that
He's
sort of orphanage type thing he belonged to is like basically a fundy, I say Christian, but basically a fundamental religious group.
yeah, basically, yeah. And he is traumatized. He's got PTSD. It really does read that way. He's in a terrible position. He's abused by people that he trusts, and it basically kind of manifests into something violent,
Yeah.
but not with any intention of being cruel.
No,
So
he is exploited as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he is exploited. And I would be interested to see sort of how that can kind of, how that's sort of really discussed and how that's looked at, because again, we're sort of going in towards sort of talking about negligence and things along those lines. Anyway, this is such a jolly topic. I would quite like to see disability shown within the Harry Potter universe, because if you can have a character who wears glasses, you can have a character who's disabled in other ways.
Yeah, I'd agree. We can look at more fiction that is a bit more representative in that way as well, I think.
Yes. Now, what was the book that you wanted to talk about next?
Oh, that wasn't me.
Oh, well, no, I did want to talk about Six of Crows.
Well, let's go on to Six of Crows.
Now, Six of Crows, I think, is probably one of the best books. One of the best YA books that I've ever read.
Yeah. No, it's a really, really good universe.
Yeah, it's a fantastic universe. It's a fantastic duology. I would love to see more out of this world, because I think there's just so much being offered there. And it represents disability.
Yeah.
In a number of ways, which I really, really like. Now, actually, I really like it because it represents one of the disabilities that I have, which is dyslexia, which isn't usually seen as a disability. In fact, dyslexia is usually just seen as someone being thick or stupid or not putting up enough effort into something. Now, that's obviously not by everyone, but it's not usually recognised as a disability. Which it is. It is a disability. It's a mental disability, and it causes people to look at the world and see things and process information in different ways.
Yeah.
And one of the characters, Wylan, has got severe dyslexia, and I really, really appreciated that, because his dyslexia is obviously a lot more severe than mine. Wylan can't read at all. And obviously, fortunately, I can read. It would be very hard to be a writer if I couldn't. But Wylan uses tricks, which I used when I was trying to learn to read and when I was trying to get by in school, when everyone else was so far ahead of me, which is that he memorizes things audio using audio, and he's got a very good audio memory. But the way his memory works, the way he looks at things, the way his mind works, you know, he's very good at music, but he's not good with words. I just really liked seeing it. And the struggle that he went through and the perception that he was stupid because of it, or the perception that he was broken, to the point that these are spoilers, I'm sorry, but his father tried to kill him.
Yeah, his father, first of all, tries to disinherit him, then tries to kill him so he can have an heir who's more perfect.
Yeah. And that is amazing. for a number of reasons, not very good, amazing, but it is amazing, because it was actually the first time I'd seen dyslexia looked at and treated with severity and recognised for what it was, and recognised on an extreme level the social implications of having a learning disability.
Yeah, definitely.
So I really liked that. But of course, that isn't the only disability that Leigh Bardugo represents.
No, there's Kaz as well, who had an injury in his younger life that means that he now needs to walk with a cane.
Yeah.
And I saw an interesting discussion on this on Tumblr. She was getting... the author, that is, she was getting hate mail from a particular quarter saying mm-hmm. that she had exploited, not represented, someone who had to walk with a cane or with difficulty walking, because at one point Kaz manages to run and then jump across rooftops and things, and somebody else came out and said, well, actually, I have a very similar disability, and I'm not saying I can jump across rooftops, but I could certainly make myself run if I had to. It just means that I will spend the rest of the week in pain and I'll barely be able to move. But in, you know, in extremis, I can actually do that if I need to.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't really say your disability isn't disabled enough for us because everybody's a little bit different.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is actually the author herself does have a disability with her leg. Which causes her terrible pain. I can't remember what it is, but you know, within the opening pages of the book, she literally says that she and Kaz limped through the story together.
Yeah.
So this was a pain that it was coming from a place of truth and honesty from her. And I felt that Kaz was actually really represented very well, because I think often a common thing is that with a lot of disabled people is that you might see a disabled person who uses a wheelchair walking around.
Yeah.
And there's this whole argument of, oh, what, you're walking around, you don't need a wheelchair. And like, that's not how disability works.
No, it's okay? Like, I have good days and bad days. Some days I need a wheelchair, like really bad, and some days I can. Yeah. You know, I like to walk when I can, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, someone else made a point of, yeah, they might not use the wheelchair when they're at home, but that's because when they're at home, they can lie on the floor when they need to. They can get help when they need to. They can just curl up into a ball and cry if they're in pain if they need to. You can't do that in public. Well, I mean, you can, but, you know, it's not socially accepted.
No, it's not.
So I really liked the way that Kaz was represented because he did things like running, like jumping, but usually afterwards you would see that he would get from his point of view and he would say he was in pain. He was in pain. And there was this interesting thing because there was this implication. At one point, Kaz was being tailored and healed up at one point. And they said, oh, why didn't you allow yourself to be healed up for a little bit longer? And he said, because the healer sort of took it too far. And one of the characters thinks she wonders whether the healer offered to try and fix Kaz's leg.
Yeah.
Which kind of gives this implication that it might be possible, actually, for him to have his leg fixed. But it's sort of a part of him, and he doesn't kind of want to let it go. And it's not this, he'll be better if his leg is fixed. At no point does Kaz think that. You don't ever see him thinking, oh God, I wish, you know, I think he complains about his leg every now and again, but it's not a kind of, this is the only problem with me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's actually sort of a part of his identity, and he doesn't really mind it in that sense. It's part of kind of who he is, but he has this other disability, which is to do with trauma. And you could argue that it is a disability. He can't stand people touching him. It literally just, he just can't stand it. It's like pain almost. It's like chronic pain for him, to the point where he'll actually pass out. He'll start puking. He just can't stand people touching him.
And to be honest, it reads more like a phobia to me. A very, very strong phobia.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But it's, I can't say the word. Not deliberately.
Debilitating?
Debilitating, thank you. D's and B's for me. I mean, it's terrible. Imagine, do you know how long I called myself Mabalen? Anyway,
I quite like that. We can shorten it to Mab.
I quite like that as well now. when my dad went abroad, I was like, my dad is in Abu Dhabi. You mean Abu Dhabi? Yes, same thing. D's and B's, man. D's and B's. Anyway, so yeah, that word that you just said that I'm not going to try and even try and repeat. So yeah, I really like that. There is, of course, actually one more disability which is represented, which is ADHD. And that is actually linked in with the magic, but not made any less sort of relevant or topical. And it links into addiction. And that's with Jasper, the character of Jasper, who just can't sit still. He has ADHD, and he's not treated like some hyperactive, annoying child because of it. I really like Lee Bardugo's writing, because she hasn't just limited herself to writing within the stereotypes or the archetypes that we usually see of these certain characters.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I think that's an excellent example of actually how you can have disability within a world which contains amazing magic.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to talk about Carve the Mark a little bit.
Okay.
You've got a main character in that. I'm not going to touch any of the racial stuff from Carve the Mark today, okay, because it was a different topic.
We'd be here for a while.
So you've got your two main characters, but the female main character suffers from very severe chronic pain, and it's to do with her current gift. All of them have current gifts. If you think about sort of like the Force, it's a little bit like that.
Yep.
And her gift is being able to kill someone with a touch.
Right.
The drawback of that, ultimately, is the fact that she can't stand to be touched herself. And she really is in physical pain all the time. And sometimes it's really, really bad. There was a lot of hits that a lot of people didn't like the way it was represented by Veronica Roth. I didn't think it didn't gel with my experiences of chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's experiences of being a chronic pain sufferer are different, so I wouldn't say it was wrong. And Veronica Roth is a chronic pain sufferer herself.
Yeah.
Having said that, there was one bit where I was kind of rolling my eyes.
Yeah.
And it's where you've got the main character saying her pain was basically a gift because it let her know that she was strong enough to bear it. And I'm like, there's a slightly too Christian tint to that message for a start, as in like suffering makes you a better person.
Yeah.
So that leaves a slightly nasty taste in the mouth. And also it's really cheesy, and it kind of diminishes the fact that people do suffer and perhaps they'd rather not be suffering.
Yeah, and that it's okay to not want to suffer.
Yeah, and it is that element of not wanting to suffer, not making you a bad person. As in, it's all very well to say, oh, well, suffering purifies, pain purifies, fine. But if you're not free to choose not to suffer, then it's all a moot point, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a bit troubling.
So I think that's where, for me, I wouldn't say it was tone deaf, but it certainly was a couple of sour notes in a symphony.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Speaking of which, as you've been talking, I've realised just how many things I've loaded M down with over the series.
You what?
I've loaded Emlyn down with in Unveiled, because I've given her brain damage, which has brought on her childhood stutter much worse than before. Stutters happen generally because something traumatic happened to you in childhood.
Yeah.
And sometimes you grow out of them. I did. And sometimes you don't. Or sometimes they can get worse when something else happens. So brain damage, her childhood stutter. She's got trauma dyslexia. She used to be able to read fine and now she has difficulty with it.
Yeah.
And she's a chronic pain sufferer.
So yeah. I didn't know you had a stutter as a child.
Most people don't remember, or they don't notice. It was only for a few years, but I did.
Oh.
It was quite bad.
Well, you say most people don't remember. I didn't know you as a child.
Fairness,
on account of the fact I wasn't born.
You weren't born. That's no excuse.
Sorry, Jules, I failed you.
You did. No, it was only... weirdly, I'd almost forgotten it myself until I started writing the character. And then I was like, oh, the reason this is ringing true is because there were those few years there where I had real difficulty talking. So it's strange. And, you know, I'd completely forgotten about it. Sometimes now I'll trip over words when I get very tired or I get too excited about things and start talking too fast.
Yeah. I remember, but I occasionally, when my anxiety sort of hits me, I can struggle to get words out. And obviously also because of the dyslexia as well, my brain can suddenly sometimes just do a complete blurt. And I remember one point sitting in a restaurant trying to ask for tea and just the words wouldn't come out. And it never hit me that bad before. And the waitress was like, "Do you just want to point at it in the menu?" And I'm like, just give me a second. I will get the words. Because I was like, and she interrupted me and I just sort of glared at her and I was like, "No, let me get this out. I can do it." Because it had never happened to me. It was very peculiar, that bad. But
yeah, I still get that remembrance of the frustration of it.
Yeah.
being really quite quick in your thoughts and yet just not being able to get the words out.
There's nothing worse than being betrayed by your own... I say there's nothing worse. Obviously, there is. There are terrible, terrible things and all of that. Being betrayed by your own body, by your own brain.
Yeah.
It's just... It's awful, and the way that that can make you feel. And I think it that kind of ties into why, you know, seeing ourselves represented and seeing, yeah, seeing yourself represented in media is so important. And the reason why people give such huge backlash against characters who are disabled, who people say, oh, no, that doesn't represent me, is because there's so little representation that the representation that you do get is meant to represent everybody. And that's never going to be the case.
Yeah, and that's obviously where you get tokenism. And you can have people, obviously like Bardugo, who wrote really good, well-rounded characters. You know, the unique selling point was not, oh, I've got a cast full of disabled and different race and different sexuality type characters.
Yeah.
They were well-rounded characters who, you know, told a good story between them. But, of course, everyone's like, oh, it's representative. It's like, well, it doesn't represent me. It's like, well, it's not her job to represent every single version of it everywhere.
No, you know, how can she?
how can you possibly do that? I read a book recently called 27 Hours. I have to assume that the author was really trying to be inclusive and representative. And unfortunately, what happened was you ended up with diversity bingo. The characters didn't have any character. And they literally were just their sexuality, their colour, their race, their creed, their religion, and their, you know, their ableness.
Yeah.
And it overshadowed everything else about the whole thing. And to me, it's been, some people have said they really loved it because, yay, representation. And I'm like, yeah, but there still needs to be a plot and there still needs to be characters. There still needs to be a story.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what you're doing is extreme tokenism. You're not actually doing representation, in my opinion.
Yeah. You are. And I guess that's actually a reason why I really like Unveiled. And I particularly like the Unveiled books, which are yet to come, but the last book is fantastic. Because actually, it's great. It's very diverse. It really is. You've got, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but sort of some of the characters who are going to turn up, you know, include a black person, a Scottish, Japanese woman, people of various sexualities, disability as well, and through Emmeline. I really like that, and because it represents the colourful truth of what happens when you just go out into society and actually look around. And I think the other thing is that a lot of people, there are a lot of disabilities which are invisible.
Yeah.
And you might not know this anything about a person. I mean, people don't look at me and automatically assume that I have a learning disability. In fact, the opposite, you know, when I mention it to people, they're genuinely shocked. And then this is the other thing. The other thing, which is because you can now function in a way which is considered to be sort of typical of everybody else. People, you know, the amount of people who said, oh, so are you no longer dyslexic? Because I can read and write. And I'm like, no, I will be dyslexic for the rest of my life. It wasn't a monster that I got rid of and now I'm dyslexic free, okay? It wasn't an illness. My brain will always be dyslexic. I will always have this moment. I will always have this problem with my memory, which means that I cannot move things from my short-term memory into my long-term memory very well, which is why I'm terrible at remembering names and stuff like that. But I can usually remember harmonies and melodies. So I that'll always be the case for me. It just makes me laugh. It's like, but you've written books now, so you must be over your dyslexia. You're marking papers at the moment. I'm like, yes, and it takes me twice as long to mark other people's papers because I see a problem and I cannot identify it.
It's like, in a way, I kind of get it because people obviously can only go from their own personal experience. So you're outside their remit, just like I'm outside their remit. And when I try and explain what having temporal lobe epilepsy is like, or what having chronic pain, which is all linked with that, is like, I tend to get a very wary side eye out of them.
Yeah.
Because it's like, are you sure you're talking about epilepsy? You're not talking about like being, you know, schizophrenic or anything, because it does share a lot of characteristics, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that, again, you know, I could be schizophrenic, and if I was schizophrenic, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm about to pull your liver out through your nostrils.
Yeah.
You know? So I think it really is kind of a, people don't understand, and I was astounded when they finally did diagnose me years ago.
Yeah.
With temporal lobe epilepsy. How many people just didn't understand that it, you know, okay, it was a long-term life condition. It was going to be with me forever. I was going to have to live my life completely differently.
Yeah.
But what they didn't seem to get was the fact that I wasn't just going to suddenly throw myself on the floor and have a full-on tonic-clonic seizure, because I don't have those seizures.
Yeah.
You know, you can, there's so many different types of epilepsy, and I wouldn't expect everyone to know all of them, but I'd expect people to sort of say, oh, right, so how does that affect you? Not, oh, God, do I need to hold your tongue kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, if anyone is ever having a full-on tonic-clonic seizure in front of you, just make sure they can't pull anything down on top of themselves and leave them to it, you know? Yeah.
Don't put your hands in their mouth.
Don't do anything like that. You will lose fingers.
Yeah, don't try and restrain them either. Just make sure that they're in a safe place. And when they're over, maybe roll them over into the recovery position.
Yeah.
Put a pillow under their head.
Just as a little side note. So, and it sucks, but I think you've got to have a bit of a sense of humour with it as well.
I do think so. But I mean, epilepsy is another one, because that's the only kind of epilepsy you ever see in fiction. Seizures, that's it. And if you see things, then you're schizophrenic.
Yeah, you know, that's not the way it works, really.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I will be fair and say that I had a friend who had similar epilepsy to me. Unfortunately, he died earlier in the year. He had a seizure in his sleep and his wife didn't wake up.
I'm very sorry.
So we've lost him. He had the same type of epilepsy, and having seen him have a seizure, it is actually genuinely quite frightening. You don't know what's going on. The first time you see that, I can understand why people react that way, because there's a genuine uncanniness. As in, you look into somebody's eyes, they're acting in a really strange way, and the lights are on and nobody's home. It's really quite peculiar.
Yeah.
So I get it, but at the same time, you know, it kind of sucks, the person who's got epilepsy.
Yeah, it does.
To have people frightened of them because of something they can't help. Their brain doesn't like them very much, basically, and every so often it tries to kill them. So, you know, bear that in mind.
just the idea is like, da, 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 da. Oh, I see that you're relaxing there. Well, what about now? No, not now.
The road sway sideways. You
seem like this is a bad time for me to be disturbing you. Well, guess what?
about not suddenly being non-dyslexic anymore. It's a case of, well, you have a disability, but you've learned to work around and inhabit the world in spite of that.
Yeah, basically, that is actually how most disabled people basically function within society. Isn't that we're cured, it's just that we... And the way we're able to present ourselves as people expect is because actually we have tricks that allow us to do things instead. So the way that we have little tricks of the trade that mean that we can get away with things so that you don't recognize. And again, that was why I really liked Weiland, because he had this whole trick where people didn't realize he couldn't read until much later, because what he did was that he would memorize each of the scripts and pretend to read them. And actually, I did the same thing. When I was learning to read, I would listen to Harry Potter audio tapes, and I would memorize the audio tapes and then pretend and then sort of read along with them. And my grandmother realized that actually I wasn't reading the text at all. I was just reciting what had been done, and she knew because I wasn't reading the stuff that was on the page. I just really liked the way that that was represented, and I just felt that that was such a good representation of disability within a fantasy genre, because so often there is that response, which is one thing I don't agree with J.K. Rowling, which is that if there's magic, disability won't be a thing. And actually, I think that's just a bit,
It's I don't the two things I don't like are when you have a disability that's used as a unique selling point, in the sense of it, I don't know, it feels disrespectful. It feels exploitative to me.
Yeah.
If it's part of the plot, that's fine. And obviously I've done that myself with I Belong to the Earth. Part of Em's problem is the fact that she can't articulate very well and she can't read, and that is kind of a, at that point in time, that's a real issue for her.
Yeah.
But there's at no point in the series is there a magical, okay, well, we're going to cure you now, and you ever get to the end of the fourth book, it's kind of like,
yeah,
you know which bit I'm talking about. Nobody at any point ever says, oh, well, in that case, we'll just like make you perfect again. We'll undo the brain damage.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's yours for life. That's your souvenir.
Enjoy. Au revoir.
But yeah, it's kind of insulting in a way. And it's kind of like you were saying with Kaz, in the sense of him not wanting his leg completely fixed. He'd become a different person.
He would.
Through learning to manage it.
But the other thing is that I think it's important to recognise that I could turn around and sort of say, if someone turned around and said, I could get rid of your dyslexia completely, just like that, I could get rid of your dyslexia. I don't think it's wrong for me to have a moment to think about whether I'd want that or not.
No, absolutely.
And I don't think it's wrong to have days and to have moments where, if, when I'm really struggling to the point where, you know, and it does get like that. I end up choking up. There are actually, you know, I'm close to crying because of something really stupid. I can't get past something that I do know, and it's so frustrating. And when it happens in public, it's so incredibly embarrassing. And at times like that, I do sort of wish, I wish I just didn't have this. I wish I didn't have this. And it's such a small thing as well. Dyslexia doesn't, the dyslexia that I have doesn't stop me functioning in the way that I want to function. It doesn't stop me being the person I want to be. And yeah, it took a lot of work and a lot of clever thinking and help from people in order to be able to get where I am now, so that I could overcome the difficulties that my disability had given me. But, you know, I'm actually in a very fortunate position. And even so, you know, I can experience those moments where I say, I wish that I didn't have this. And then I can also turn around and say, actually, no, this is part of my identity. It's part of who I am. And I recognize, again, this is me coming from a position of privilege, because my disability isn't stopping me from doing what I want to do. And there will be people with disabilities, and their disability is preventing them from being who they want to be and preventing them from doing the things that they want to do. And there will be other people in the world who have a disability who are proud of their identity, and, you know, rightfully so. And again, that is the problem, in that if we only have very, very limited representation of disability, someone is going to be upset because they are not going to be represented. The disabled person who wants to get rid of their disability will say, yes, I see myself in this character. Whereas the disabled person who actually is proud of their disability, who feels it is a humongous part of them, that it doesn't get in the way of who they want to be, and that this, well, we'll cure it and then you'll be normal narrative is insulting, it's going to be very, very upset. There's just no right answer. That's the problem. And it's the moment that we look at disability as if it is a problem, that's when things get a little bit troublesome. Because disability isn't a problem, it's just a thing.
Yeah, okay? It's another factor. It isn't, you are not your disability, ultimately. You're more than that. If someone said to me, would I want to get rid of my epilepsy? I'd be like, actually, I'm not sure. And I know that sounds weird. I'd quite like to get rid of chronic head pain. It'd be nice to know what it's like to not have pain in your head, from my perspective. But the actual epilepsy itself, because of the type of epilepsy it is, and because, yeah, okay, it really does suck. But I think it's given me a really unusual outlook on life, and I draw on that outlook a lot in my writing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that disabilities come with two sides, and they will change the way you look at the world, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
It's just about weighing the pros and cons as wrong, but it's just going to be about the individual at the end of the day. And that's why there's never any simple answer when it comes to representing disability. only in that we need to represent it more. So that if, yeah, in one film maybe you find that you're not represented, you're going to find that you're represented somewhere else.
Yeah, agreed. And on that note, I think we've run out of time.
Well then, what do you guys think? Please weigh in on the argument. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Do you have a disability that you wish was being represented? Or do you have a disability which you feel has been represented very, very well? Leave us a comment, and thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.